So I wasn't sure if I was going to sit up here or down there, and I felt a little weird about it. And Jigme was like, "Oh, just get over yourself and sit up there. It's good for you and it's good for everybody." Just so I was like, "Okay." She always tells me what to do. Sometimes. So I taught a little bit of this in Guadalajara, and so some of you were there, and I'm not going to go over much of the same stuff again. I'll just review a little bit. But, yeah, it's cool. Oh. So the poster that we were looking at here, and we're going to be looking at again, is, say, Dzogchen. Dzogchen. So that's, Geshe La lately has been calling it the garden for collecting good karma. And I think it's what's often translated as the merit field. And in the Lam Rim, there's a lot of instruction for meditation and a lot of instruction for visualizations to do in those meditations and to prepare you for those meditations. And an important visualization that's really emphasized in the Lam Rim is the merit field. So you can, if you want, learn this poster and try to learn who they all are and memorize them and see the blessings of every single one of them pouring down into you. I think it's a little bit difficult to do all of that, but and Geshe La usually emphasizes that he likes to visualize pretty much just his teacher, and that summarizes the whole merit field. So before we get into this, don't get overwhelmed by the feeling that you have to learn them all if you want to meditate properly on the Lam Rim or something like that. It's just pretty cool to know. And this particular poster is one that we have at Diamond Mountain. It's on silk and it's really beautiful. And how did I end up doing this? I was transporting it and I broke it. The glass, you were there, right? I think we were moving it from your car to my truck. And then I had to get it fixed. And Geshe La was like, "Well, why don't you just scan it?" So I went and had it scanned. And that's how we have this image of it now. And then he was like, "Why don't we work on learning it and translating it?" So that's what I've been working on with him for the last year or so. And we've covered almost every single lama. You can't really see it on here, but if you look closely at it, and Aaron bought me like a nice big magnifying glass, and then you get close in, you can see that written in next to every single one of the lamas is their name. Well, that's not one of the lamas. That's Ganden. That's the Buddhas in paradise overlooking what's going on, which I didn't know last year when I taught this. But here's some of the lamas, and you can see their names are written in right there next to them. And so what I did last time was kind of went through one by one a lot of them and said who they were. And I'll briefly mention who they are because you guys are probably interested to know. This is also in a version of this poster, not the exact same one, is in Liberation in Your Hands, Volume 1. The gold one, and there's a little fold-up poster of that made of paper, and it's almost the same. And Art Engel did the same thing where he translated and figured out who all the lamas were, so you can look at that too if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of it. But zoom back out, Tim, for a minute. Oh, a question. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I'll translate myself. Yo voy a traducir, traducir, por favor. Ah, soy un poco nervioso. You know, Geshe La said it wasn't the same, so I'm going by that. It might be the same. I think he hasn't thoroughly examined. It happens to be for sale in the bookstore.
Oh, and we can buy it?
Yeah.
But not a digital copy?
Oh, I can send it to you. I can give it to you before the retreat's over. It might be too big to email. But if you want a digital copy of it, I'll get it.
Because I was wondering how you zoomed in. It's like, oh, I can't really even look that close.
If you want a digital copy, I'll try to make it available.
Thanks.
Okay, now, despacio. So what I was saying... In the Lam Rim, which is what we're studying with Geshe Michael, a very popular visualization for doing in your meditation and for warming up for your meditation is this, the merit field, or some version of it. And we're getting at this place in the text now. So I'm just going to describe a little bit now what this is. And then I'll talk about some of the particular lamas and their stories, because that's more interesting than if I just go through all of them, you guys are going to be like, so, first of all, we're a Gelugpa lineage. So there's four main sects. Sorry for all you guys who totally know all this, but some of you don't. There's four sects, or five, depending who you ask, of Tibetan Buddhism. And we're Gelugpas, Gelugs. And the hero of our lineage, you know, at least as far as I understand, is this great being here in the center, Jaiswankhapa. What were his dates, Johnny? I always forget that one. And so he's pictured in the center, and he kind of just embodies the Buddha. Yeah. And don't forget it. Right, Aaron? So he's the hero of our lineage, and so he's pictured here at the center with his two principal disciples just below him, Kedrup Jay and Gyaltsub Jay. Actually, they're in the smaller version of him. There, right where Tim has the hand. In the middle, it's just him. So, hold on, go up. Can you go? It has a mind of its own right now, right? Okay. So down, anyway, at the bottom, you've got these Dharma protectors, and they're painted on the front of Sarah Monastery too. So those are just the four principal Dharma protectors. I have no idea what their names are. I asked people, I don't know if anybody knows. Somebody knows. And the whole thing is on a giant lotus. So those of you who've gone through some of the higher classes know that you're always picturing people on different types of beautiful ornate thrones with lotuses and moons and suns and whatever else that I don't know about. So this whole thing is on a giant lotus, and it's held aloft by lions who are actually bodhisattvas. So sometimes they emanate as these snow lions in Tibet. So go back up now, please, if you can. So represented to the left and the right of Jaiswankhapa. Oh, cool. Don't look directly into it, right? Okay. So Jaiswankhapa to us is basically a Buddha. And here to his left and his right, we have the two great lineages of Buddhism, the two wings. Geshe Law has been teaching about this, right? So does anybody want to tell me what they are? Yeah, right. So do you remember which side the wisdom is on? Left is wisdom, right? Is which left? Jaiswankhapa's left. So that's the wisdom side, right? Okay. And that's compassion. Good. Or as Geshe Michael usually says, love. These days, great love. So... Sorry? What did he say? So, does anybody... Well, most of you guys know. That's Manjushri. And he's... I guess he's the head of the wisdom side. He's a bodhisattva or a Buddha, depending on who you ask. Am I talking slow enough? Okay. Okay, so he's... Depending on who you ask, we'll call him a Buddha. And he represents the wisdom side of things. And he's often bowed down to in the beginning of a text. And oftentimes, it's a compassion text or a text on bodhicitta, and they'll be bowing down to Manjushri. Maybe that's to balance it out. I'm not sure the reason for that. But so he's in the center of this group. And then he's surrounded by the Indian... masters of the wisdom side. So included And that's, does anybody have any ideas who'd be there? Yeah. Who else? He's not. I thought he would be also, but Master Shantideva is, yeah. I mean, even though his books are also about love, he's basically, because he was received teachings directly from Manjushri, I think that he's put on the wisdom side. Master Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, not Master Dignaga. For some reason, this is interesting. Dharmakirti, the only place you find him on this poster is in the, don't go there right now, but in the bottom of the poster, there's a row of Buddhas. And one of them, they're just all pictures of Shakyamuni Buddha. And it's all just like the Buddha families and all these names of past Buddhas. And then it just says Dharmakirti. I was like, wow. No, Maitreya's, he's the head of the compassion side. He's like the big boss over there. I'm going to pull this up so that I can show you, so I can tell you who's there. I won't go through all of them, but I will go through the wisdom and the compassion, the Indian masters. Oh, whoops. Oh, forget it. I'll go through the other ones. I had so many documents with this on it. So anyway, it's Aryadeva, Nagarjuna, Shantideva, a couple other great Indian masters of wisdom, Vimukti Sena, guys that I had never heard of before, and with Master Manjushri in the middle. And then below that, go ahead and go down. These different groupings represent the different groups that Geshe-la was talking about. So after you leave this top grouping, then you get into the Tibetan lamas. So this finishes with Master Sirlingpa, Lord Atisha, and Dromtenje. And that's, Dromtenje is actually included in the Indian masters, even though he's Tibetan, because he just has to be next to Lord Atisha, I guess. And then from here, it picks up with just all the different Lamrim lineages. And it's the same on both sides of the poster. So, and I couldn't even tell at first. I thought these were supposed to be rows or something. But they're all grouped around a central figure like this. And you can tell because there's Tibetan numbers written in there. So he's always one. And then it's like 2, 3, 4, 5. They go around like that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it's often from lama to disciple. So these are just different central figures. And then you have their disciples and their disciples' disciples grouped around them. And this one is the ones who concentrate on their lama's oral advices. Do you guys remember the Geshe-la was talking about this in class? So this one represents the oral advices lineage. Hold on, let me tell you what the next one is. This is the Lam Rimpas. The Kadampa Lamrimpas. So they were the early Tibetans, the hippie Buddhists of Tibet. And these are the Shumpawas. So the people who were more masters of the classics, right? Tsenipas. They were the people who went a little bit deeper than just the Lamrimpas. They learned the logicians and the debaters and those masters of the five great classics. All right, go to the other side. And I'll just look at Maitreya's group real quick. And then we'll get into some more interesting stuff. So that in the center right there is Lord Maitreya, the Buddha to come. And he's surrounded by the various Indian masters. And it's the same deal on the bottom as Lord Atisha. I can't really see right now which one is him, but it's this one, Jowoje. See the two Naros, those of you who know Tibetan. So that's Jowoje, and that must be Dromtenje. And then it picks up with the Tibetans down here. And these three groups are the exact same lamas that are on the other side. So the only difference really in symmetry on the whole poster is Maitreya's group and... Here, go back up, please. Maitreya's group and Manjushri's group. So I'll just mention some of the people to you. Oh, you have a question?
I was just wondering, because that's got a stupa in it. I was wondering, what is
this?
The right, go down the where you're saying right there.
Oh yeah.
Wouldn't that be a t-shirt?
So there's a few lay people in there, but that's pretty good as a layman to make it to the big boss group. So some of the other people that are mentioned there is Master Vasubandhu, a master named Master Virochana, Hari Bhadra, who you guys probably know. Ser Lingpa is also mentioned on this side, of course, because he taught Bodhicitta. And then there's some other people I've never heard of. Paramasena, Vimuktisena, Kusali. So that's that group. And I'll just tell you real quick what else we're looking at. So can you zoom back out? Is there any questions so far on the poster? So these three groups are exactly the same as these three groups. Yeah, same people, same groupings, same lamas.
Is everyone depicted there a great scholar or someone that has written something, or what does it take to be on to the poster?
you trying to get on there?
No.
Good answer. I don't know the criteria, but it's all in our lineage, you know. So basically, this poster, it looks like it was probably made by Pabonka Rinpoche or Trijang Rinpoche, probably by Pabonka Rinpoche's students, but during his time, because he's not on it, but his lama's on it, which I'll show you in a second. And I think it was just the people who were involved in our lineage. So since we're, you know, Gelugpa, Tibetan Buddhists, the Lama Rim is really important. The five great classics are really important. So it's the particular masters who have either orally or scripturally passed on the classics or the Lama Rims. Does that make sense? To us, because we're getting it from Pabonka Rinpoche, through Trijang Rinpoche, through Ken Rinpoche, through Geshe Michael. So it's like this poster is a relatively direct relation to how we're getting these teachings as far back as Lord Buddha, basically, because Lord Maitreya and Manjushri were disciples of Lord Buddha when they were apparently just bodhisattvas. So, as far as I know, that's what it takes. You gotta be good. You definitely gotta be. You gotta be really good at this stuff. These are the practice lineages, which is a code word for tantric lineages. And I'll tell you real quick what they are, because it's kind of cool. Man, I should have organized my notes better. I didn't think scrolling would take so long. Well. Oh, by the way, in the emptiness side, we also had Master Buddhapalita, Master Chandrakirti, Master Shantideva. Nagarjuna was number two to Manjushri. That's pretty cool. And then it went to Lord Atisha and Drumtajay. And sorry, Master Salingpa's not on that side, which I should have known. So it appears that these are the tantric lineages that came down to Pabonka Rinpoche. I'm sure he had many more, but these were the ones that were important for the poster. So it's Guhya Samaja, which Geshe-la translated as the secret collection. And then the second one, so I'm going from right to left of these vertical lineages. It's Guhya Samaja, Bhairava, the Lord of Terror. And then the third one is just kind of interesting. We had a lot of trouble figuring out what it was. We figured this out, all this different groupings, by finding as many of the names as we could that we could, you know, read. And then using the ACIP database and grouping them together, like finding them where they appeared close to each other in scriptures, and then tried to find what lineage they were representing. It's pretty amazing. It was really amazing for me to get to sit with Geshe-la and see how the ACIP database works and see how easy it is. And like, I can't imagine how anybody got anywhere before we had it. Like, how did anybody study anything or find scriptures? Because these books were like hand carved and then stashed in libraries and stacked up. And I've been to the monastery and they just have like a million books, and somebody must know the order of them, but they're all wrapped in cloth. So, I mean, you can't, there's nothing to read on them. I don't know. I think if we don't get enlightened really quickly, then, you know, if we're not in a position to do it, then I don't know who is, because it's really convenient what they've made for us and how really great they've got it. The same with running a retreat. I have no idea how this would have been done before the internet and cell phones. Like, it's crazy. I can barely remember what it was like. Like, did you have to call people and organize things? I don't know. Okay. Anyway, so this one is the lineage of the three nested beings. So for those of you who were in Phoenix, Geshe-la went over this a lot, how it was, you would see your own lama, and then within your own lama's heart, you would see Maitreya, I think. And then in Maitreya's heart, you would see Vajradhara. And then there was a couple different variations of the visualization. But this is a particular tantric lineage of that visualization, and it was also called in this particular, it was combining the secret collection, which is Griha Samaja, the union of the spheres, Chakrasamvara, thank you, and the Lord of Terror, Bhairava. So I guess it's seeing one inside the other, like Russian dolls, like one being inside of the other, inside of the other, and that's what that lineage is representing. And Vajradhara is at the top of that one. Obviously, Bhairava's at the top of his, and Griha Samaja. Sorry? Tim, would you show them Vajradhara? This. I don't like pointing the red thing at Vajradhara. Like, that just doesn't seem cool. I know. yeah. This one here to the left of my... Yeah, he doesn't... Yeah, bliss laser. So you can't see Bhairava here, but with our high-tech magnifying glasses, me and Geshe-la could see. And there's Griha Samaja with many arms. So here, Vajradhara, yeah, he just looks. He's got long hair, if you could see. And that's the Buddha when he teaches Tantra, as Geshe-la mentioned. Okay. And then Manjushri comes second in that lineage. Interestingly enough. And then Jason Kappa's third, which was really cool because when Geshe-la was teaching me this, he didn't think Jason Kappa was going to be that high up, but I read the Tibetan before he got to it. And I was like, it says like Lobsang Drakpa or something. And he's like, no, that's not who it is. And he was like trying to come up with, he's like, it has to be some Indian guy if it's going to be a person. And I was like, and then he was like, you were right. And I was like, I'm so happy. Am I going slow enough? I think when I get nervous, I start talking fast. Okay. Maybe we should do a meditation. He wants to. We'll get there. Hold on.
So the five lineages are going vertically. Is that what we're saying here? The five tantric?
Yeah.
All the way down to Tsongkhapa?
Yeah. They go all the way down to Tsongkhapa. Jason Kappa, Vajradhara. That's Vajradhara to the left of the red pointer.
No, who was it you said that you were surprised?
That I was right about? Jason Kappa.
It was. Wait, so point again?
Maybe it says, it says Lobsang Drakpa.
Were you a point?
This gentleman.
Oh, there.
That's our hero, whose dates are. Well, me and Johnny teach a class in Phoenix, and every time somebody says Jason Kappa, Johnny like shouts it.
3 down.
3 down from Vajradhara, Manjushri, Jason Kappa.
Long here too?
No. No, Jason Kappa. He's got his headgear or something.
And, like,
the tantric teachers, it looks like in this form they're all wearing some sort of ornate crown or something, which is kind of cool. And this gentleman is probably not a monk, or these I think are not monks. So that must have been more of like a lay lineage. Let's see what that one is.
What are the names?
Which ones?
The lay people there.
We're getting there. That is the lineage of the Kadampa practice of the 16 drops. So that took us a really long time to figure out. And I don't think even Geshe-la was that familiar of it with it. But I think it's some ancient practice. So I guess the Kadampas, a lot of them weren't monks. That's what he always refers to them as, the hippie lamas. They were kind of more like us, you know, like Buddhism had just arrived there. They weren't just getting ordained like crazy. It was still more fresh in Tibet. So that's Lord Atisha.
Oh.
And then below him is Dromden Jay.
Of course. Okay.
And then Ngok Lekpe Shirab and Shirab Gelsen and Puchungwa Shunu Gelsen and several others. There's a Karmapa in there. let's see. I don't recognize any of these other names. If anybody really wants to get into it with me, then I'm happy to show you on our own time all of the lamas. For those of you who like reciting lists of lineage lamas and stuff like that. And then the last group on the right of the practice lineages is the lineage of the four empowerments of the body mandala according to the system of Gantapada. And at the top of that lineage, for those of you who will be very interested, is the union of Chakrasamvara and Vajrayogini.
What's the name of the lineage again?
It is the lineage of the four empowerments of the body mandala according to the system of Gantapada. Gantapada, is that like elephant foot or something? And at the top of that lineage is Chakrasamvara in union with Vajrayogini. Oh,
like,
yeah.
I do like on a genealogy tree where you just put the square and then you'll put the name in and stuff. That would be really awesome.
I'm working on it. Actually,
yeah, I would help you with that.
Okay. Thanks.
Since I asked for it.
Yeah.
That would just be so helpful.
It won't be ready by the end of the retreat.
No.
But, yeah. Well, actually, Geshe-la wanted me to have it ready by Mexico. But then he's like, and I want you to produce this retreat and produce that retreat. So. Okay. I don't live there.
You don't?
No.
I see you there all the time.
You've seen, I used to, I'm from there.
Oh, you
yeah.
TBB.
Okay. We'll work on it though. We could do it. That's one cool thing about the internet.
Real quick, just Laura, in your book, in the appendix, those are numbered and all their names are in there if you look in the back of your book.
Yeah, he was just saying that some of them are different and I'm kind of neurotic about this.
I can't vouch for the correctness of that one. That was done by Art Engel.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. I don't even know Art. I'm sure he's wonderful and amazing. And I'm sure many people here do know him and think he's wonderful and amazing. I just say that because Geshe-la jokes about being jealous of him. So we did this one. Yeah, but you know, check that out and you can, we'll compare it. Maybe it's 100% equal. Naropa and Talopa are in this lineage too, for those of you who are interested. So that's that body mandala one with Vajrayogini, Sakya Pandita, Naropa, and then Pamtingpas.
Oh, wow.
Lokya Sherab Tek. Yeah. So you're probably familiar with this lineage. Jason Kappa ends it. Okay. So I'll tell you one more thing. Tim, can you go to the left a little bit, please? This way. Either way, actually. Whatever one you choose, because they're even. And then down. So below that is the more recent lamas of the Tibetan tradition, and they're also the same on both sides. So these three were the, what, does anybody remember? These three groupings? So up here, Good. Okay. You don't have to go back up. That's okay. Or go back up. Okay. So, right. The Shumpawas, the Lamrimpas, and the oral advices. And then below that, we have more recent ones. And that starts with Jesongkhapa on both sides. And then next to Jesongkhapa, you have Kedrupche and Gyaltsepche. And it continues all the way down to basically Pabongka Rinpoche's Lama, Dakpo Lama. And then it ends with him. And that's why we suspect that Pabongka had this made and laid it out.
Did you ever count how many times Jesongkhapa is pictured in this
book? No, but I could. Four times. Yeah. But Manjushri is pictured like all of these guys in the middle lineage, which was the three nested beings, all look like Manjushri. And then I did read somewhere that this is supposed to represent, even though it has Gyaltsepche and Kedrupche, it's supposed to represent your personal teacher. So I think when you're doing the visualization, by the way, it's not vertical. When you're doing the visualization, they're in front of you, seated on this lotus, and they're kind of in front of and behind each other and to the sides. Okay, so quickly, these are awesome and fierce-looking tantric deities. And then there's more of them down here. And we figured out who they all are. And then you have the four classes of tantra, starting from the highest yoga tantra on down to Kriya Tantra. Is that the lowest of the four? I think it is.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, self-made Buddhas, and listeners. So that's all these rows represent that. And when I said that Dharmakirti is here, it's because Dharmakirti is pictured in the line of the Buddhas. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, these are the Buddhas. See? Buddha, Buddha. And these are Bodhisattvas. These are self-made Buddhas, Prachika Buddhas. They're not Buddhas and they weren't self-made. They're people who attain, they saw emptiness or attain nirvana without having a teacher in the present, in the life. Am I going slow enough? In la vida, in the life in which they achieved their realizations, they didn't have a teacher present. Point to them?
Also, there was no bodhicitta in their practice.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they weren't on the bodhisattva track. They were, yeah. Well, I think that that's listeners and self-made Buddhas. But I think that the particular, the stories about that are usually talking about the listeners.
But that's the top
one
right under the fourth level of tantra.
Sorry, yes. The ones that look like Shakyamuni Buddha with the top knots are Buddhas. And then below them with the crowns, they're Bodhisattvas.
When he was the self-made, that's the top row.
So below the Bodhisattvas are the self-made Buddhas. So this row here, I hope I'm not doing anything to them with this laser. And then like these guys, yeah, they're listeners. They don't even have hair. They're just listeners. Sorry. Yeah, they're all extraordinarily realized beings and have far superior spiritual qualities to the majority of the universe, and that's why we picture them on the merit field. I just like to see you guys laugh. And below them is Dakas and Dakinis, which Geshe La wanted me to translate as warriors and their angels. And then below them is Dharma protectors. That's why these all look really fierce and they're covered with flames. And I think that they actually... No, they don't have any Tibetan names in there. So they're just random Dharma protectors.
Would that just be loaded
with
names?
Oh, you are correct, sir. There are. Yeah, they do. Okay, good. Well, we didn't get up to that yet. We're still working on that part. And then these are the protectors of the four directions, which are like more gentle looking. And the lions.
What's a listener?
What is a listener? A listener is defined as somebody who can hear Mahayana Dharma and they can teach Mahayana Dharma, but they can't put it into practice. So they're practitioners who they can reach nirvana, but they don't develop bodhicitta in their practice. And we say that in order to reach full enlightenment, okay. In Buddhism, there's a major division that I guess has occurred over the ages, probably since Lord Buddha, because there were three turnings of the wheel and he taught to people of different capacities. And through that, four major schools of Buddhism developed. Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Yogacharya, or mind only, and Mahajamika, middle way. And those schools are divided into two groups. The lower two are called Hinayana. They're called by us because we're Mahayana practitioners. So they're called Hinayana, which is the lesser vehicle. And then there's the greater vehicle, which is the Mahayana Dharma, which is what we're striving to practice, Mahayana Dharma. And the main difference between Mahayana Dharma and not Mahayana Dharma is the addition of a bodhicitta, which is what makes someone a bodhisattva. Moved it. It's back. We're back. Okay. So what makes a bodhisattva is that they have bodhicitta, which is, somebody, Erin, do you want to tell us what bodhicitta is?
Yeah, sure. It's the wish, it's the wish for total enlightenment for the sake of all beings.
Right. Thanks. So you're trying to, this is the difference between lesser vehicle and greater vehicle. Lesser vehicle is like, I'm trying to achieve enlightenment so that I can be free from suffering, which is what we're doing. It's included in our practice. But the Mahayana Dharma is inclusive of every being. So I'm trying to achieve enlightenment for the sake of every other being. And the best way to do that is to get enlightened. So we're all trying to get enlightened as quickly as possible in order to be able to most quickly bring all other beings to enlightenment so that we can eliminate suffering for everybody. So then there's lots of other teachings and lots of other practices included in order to help you get to that faster and in a more inclusive way. Like Geshe-la teaches us emptiness, and he was doing this class at Diamond Mountain, and sometimes he still does it called Sacred Translator, and they always talk about, like, you know, how many different ways does a bodhisattva want to hear emptiness taught? And, you know, a bodhisattva wants to hear emptiness taught, he says, literally infinite, which drives me nuts, because, like, what do you mean literally infinite? Literally or infinite? Yeah. A bodhisattva wants to hear literally infinite proofs of emptiness and explanations of emptiness, and that's because they want to be able to help infinite beings, and they have to be able to explain it to infinite people. So they, you know, so this is like, our practice is not just what's going to most quickly get us out. It's like, what's going to most quickly enable us to help everybody become free from suffering? And don't get it confused, because I heard like some other teachers, I was watching this, what do you call it? What's the nice way to say Hinayana? Theravadin. I saw this Theravadin teacher on YouTube the other day. And I've seen some, there's amazing Theravadin Buddhists out there and amazing teachers, but this guy, I didn't like him. And he was criticizing the Mahayana, and he was saying how the whole idea is to postpone your own enlightenment and to purposefully stay in samsara. I've heard this before too, so I think somehow that's a rumor. And Geshe-la said it's not true. And I mean, from everything I've learned, I wrote on his YouTube, I was like, I've been studying Mahayana Dharma, and we say you have to get out as fast as possible because that's the best way to help other people escape. And that's why there's, you know, practices that are supposed to help you get enlightened in one lifetime. It's not to put off your enlightenment, it's to do it quick, so that, because the best way to be able to help anybody is to, just in practical terms, the best way to help anybody is to be happy. And the best way to help somebody is to influence them. when I first was studying Mo, I had been studying for a couple of years, and I went and visited my parents, and my sister was there, and I don't see my family that often. And I was like pretty blissed out. I had just built a cabin for somebody who's in the retreat, and I helped on a lot of stuff at Diamond Mountain. I've been studying and living in the desert with some of the most brilliant and amazing people that I've ever met. And I went home and I wanted to like share that with my family and like tell my parents about emptiness and like, you know, you got to know about karma and emptiness and everything. And my sister, I'm like, no, my sister's like a PhD in philosophy, and she's been my teacher since I was very young. She's absolutely brilliant. And I'm like trying to explain stuff to her, and she's just like, you don't even need to say anything to any of us. She was like, just being around you and seeing the change that has taken place is enough. Like we experience it. Like we all appreciate it. So you don't have, we know you, you know. And I had been through a lot. I mean, like crazy stuff happened to me before that. So I went through a lot of changes over like a pretty quick period of time. Like I almost got killed. And then pretty quickly thereafter, I got into Dharma. And then I was sitting at a teaching, like when I first met Geshe Michael, and all the bunch of Diamond Mountain students were there. And I was like, who are these people? You know, these people are amazing. I want to do what they're doing. And somebody told me about Diamond Mountain. I was like, oh, I wish I had known about that. I would have liked to undertake that course of study. And then my friend Sam Muglia, maybe some of you guys know him, he goes, oh, dude, you can go out there anytime. It's free. And I was like, you know, and I had some awesome apartment in New York for like $300 and something, which is unheard of. And I just left and went and lived at Diamond Mountain in the desert. And it was really great. So yeah, I mean, going through a lot of stuff before that, almost getting killed, and then being a positive influence on my family just by sitting there. That's what I was talking about, right? Affecting people. That's my personal experience of affecting people without having to say anything. And that's why we want to get enlightened. So, okay. I want to tell you guys some stories. So that's what I was really planning to do today, is do story time, because Geshe-la is telling us a lot of amazing stuff, and he's talking about some of these lamas a lot. So I wanted to give you some of the background of those lamas. So I'll do my best. So he stayed up with me working on it a little bit the other night and the other day. It was really cool. And many of you probably know the stories of these lamas, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. I'm looking at Jigme. but I'm not. And does anybody have anything else they want to ask, though, first about the poster before? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Somebody asked me that in Guadalajara, and I was like, I don't know. And Venerable Phil was sitting there. I was like, who are they, Venerable Phil? And he was like, I don't know. Can you go back up? Yeah, a little closer. Okay, that's good. So I think somehow we can use the sun you see the sun on the right and the moon on the left. And maybe Rob has some idea, or somebody knows, like which of the paradises are associated with the sun or the moon, or with wisdom and compassion. I think at some point I came across something in a book that I was like, oh, that one's Oakman and that one's Ganden or something, or yeah. Well, this one's Ganden, right? And that does look like Lord Buddha. Would that be Oakmin? Somehow I had figured it out at some point. They're Buddha paradises, and Ganden, like we do the prayer Ganden Hayama, and then there's this whole practice of it you know, it's like a guru yoga practice, and you do this visualization of Maitreya in his paradise. We should all do it together one day. That'd be really cool if somebody wants to teach it. So that's Maitreya in his Buddha paradise with his Bodhisattva friends. The Buddha has four bodies, right? And one of them emanates to a place where they're teaching high-level Bodhisattvas. And only they can see him. That's the Sambhogakaya, one of the four bodies of a Buddha. And so, you know, those Bodhisattvas can go there and learn. And we're going to hear about somebody who did that in a second. So, should we take like a bathroom break before we continue? Okay, somebody's nodding. Did you want to say something? Or? Oh, okay.
Actually, you know what? What was the timeline of that poster? When was it made?
Oh, I didn't know. When I had it out of the glass and I brought it to them, I asked how old they thought it was, and I didn't know either. They couldn't really tell. It could have been over like 100 years old, 150 years old. The original that's at Diamond Mountain, I think it's in the temple. They're not going to let it leave now. I heard Geshe-la said that. I was out trying to do something, trying to get the internet fixed. Is the internet fixed?
Yes.
All right. It worked. Do you guys, we could go a little bit later. Do you guys want to do that and take a bathroom break? Okay, cool. Let's do it.
Oh yeah. Those guys are like floating on clouds. Those are Dakinis.
Oh, more Dakinis.
Yeah. And they're sky dancing angels if you want to get technical.
Yeah.
The clouds and, you know, sky, empty sky is just symbolic of emptiness, right? And clouds are symbolic of the dependent arising. No, not that I know of. I mean...
Did they split the wisdom compassion according to what they taught?
Yeah, good question. So, like, although the lamas on both sides taught both wisdom and compassion, it's like what they're known for. You know, if you read something by Master Nagarjuna, he teaches morality, he teaches love, but he's very known for teaching wisdom, basically as the founder of the middle way, or, you know, the one who really classified Buddhism into the way it is, as far as there being the middle way school. And the same with the other side. All those teachers, they're just more known for certain things. And actually, Master Shantideva, who we're going to talk about right now, he's on the wisdom side, but his most famous work is the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which only, I think, one chapter out of 10 chapters is on emptiness. And the rest of the chapters are on, like, compassion. And I mean, it's about bodhicitta, a lot of the book, and morality, right? Is this picking me up now? Okay. And now I'm going to try to speak a little slower. Geshe-la's really good at it. In Mexico, it was terrible. I tried to teach this with Rosa translating, and I was going so fast. I was very nervous. Now I'm just, you know, getting warmed up. So, one of my favorite lamas is Master Shantideva. So I'll tell you some stories about him. Yay! And it says in the Lamrim, I don't know if Geshe-la said it yet or we're about to get there, but it says when you do this visualization, when you visualize the lamas, don't just see them, but think about something that they've taught and think about their life, because their life is supposed to be an example for you. And something that they've taught is supposed to help you. So every morning when you contemplate all of these lamas, also contemplate one of their teachings and their life story. Or do the best you can. So let's go to the other side. Just so... No, man. No. Yeah.
Master Shantideva's in there. I think it's, where's my pointer? I believe that's Master Shantideva. Yeah. Sorry, Master. Right there. So, somebody know what his most favorite book is? His most famous book? Good, nice Sanskrit, yeah. And does anybody know like a famous quote from him? You know what? Yeah.
If there's something you can do about it, there's no point in worrying about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, there's no use in worrying about it.
Thank you. That's my favorite. If there's something that you can do about it, oh, I worry about it. Then you just do it, right? And if there's nothing you can do about it, then why worry about it? And, well, nothing you can do about it. It's amazing. It's so brilliant. So really, why worry ever? Oh, so awesome. He also said, if you can cover the world in leather, you know, or you could just put shoes on. Meaning, you know, you can try to change everything outside of you, or you can just change yourself, and maybe you won't need to worry about that. That's my interpretation. Thanks. Those were good quotes. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about his life. In the biography that I studied with Geshe-la, they're like, this biography has 7 parts, and the first part consists of this many parts, but I'll just go through a few of the most interesting things that happened. When he was young, he was a prince, as are many of the great masters, right? Why? Yeah, because they probably saw emptiness, or they did something incredible in a past life that would get them the karma to be an incredible master. So they're going to be born with everything that they could possibly need to make that practice happen. So he was a prince, and he was supposed to be crowned. And the day before he was supposed to be crowned king, he had a dream. And he had been practicing Dharma already. He'd already been studying science and art and studying Dharma with some masters. And I think he'd even had some initiations. He'd already been initiated into some sort of Manjushri practice. Manjushri of the sharp sword. Sharp Manjushri. And he had a dream the night before he was to be crowned. And in the dream was the king's throne. And sitting on the king's throne was Lord Manjushri. And Manjushri said, my one and only son, I am your spiritual guide. For you to sit with me on this throne would be improper. So he woke up and he just left. Like, he understood that it was not his place. He wasn't supposed to be crowned king. So he became a monk. And he found his way to Nalanda Monastery. So for those of you who don't know, Nalanda is an ancient great monastery in India. And it's a real place. And you can. Am I going too fast? Oh, good. You can still go there, but the monastery is just in ruins because Buddhism was wiped out in India. But it was a great monastery in its time, and so many of the greatest Indian saints and scholars that we learn about went to Nalanda and were monks at Nalanda. So that's where Master Shantideva went. And he was given his first ordination vows by a monk named Jayadeva. And that's where they gave him the name Shivadeva. Which is Tibetan for Shantideva, which his name was really Shantideva. I just like to correspond. So he became a monk, and he lived in Nalanda for a while, and his outer spiritual life was very, or his outer life was very unimpressive. he didn't appear to do anything. And I think Geshe La mentioned this the other day in class. They called him Dushe Sumbawa, right? Which means Mr. Three Thoughts, which is eat, sleep, and poop. Actually, in this particular biography, it said eat, sleep, and go. And I have the recording now. Geshe La says, probably go to the bathroom. You can picture Geshe La saying that. But yeah, he did become known as that. Like, I've heard the story before, and they call him Mr. Eat, Sleep, and Poop. And all the other monks hated him. They thought he was, you know, worthless. And they started to claim that he was not worthy of being a monk, and that he wasn't taking up any of the activities of a monk. They mentioned the three activities of a good monk, which I don't know what they are. But he wasn't fulfilling them. And Geshe La said he would have had to look it up. I don't know. Okay, yeah. Sojong, we know what it is. That's what we did last night, confessing to each other. What's Gaye and Yarne?
Summer retreat and when you get out of summer retreat.
Nice. All right. I guess if you do one, then you got to do the other.
That's the best part. They have a rule. They have to go somewhere. They have to leave the monastery and go somewhere.
Huh. Apparently, Master Shantideva wasn't even doing that. So he was really not respected. And that was his outer appearance. His inner life, he had a deep spiritual connection to Manjushri, and he would learn from him directly. So however that works out, I mean, I think that he would get into deep states of concentration where he would even be on another plane and be able to communicate directly with Manjushri. And he was composing works of Buddhist literature, but none of the other monks knew about it, and he would hide them in the rafters of his monk cell, so nobody knew they were there. So a bunch of the other monks got together and made a plan. They said, let's get him out of here. They wanted to kick him out of the monastery, or get him to get himself kicked out of the monastery. So the monks would take turns teaching, I guess practicing to be lamas. And they said, let's invite him to teach, and then he'll show what a fool he is, and when the abbot sees it, he'll just get himself kicked out. So they went to the abbot, because they thought the abbot didn't like him either, and they told him about their plan, and the abbot was like, all right, you guys ask him, you know. The abbot wasn't like totally into it, so they got a little bit worried about their plan, like, oh, maybe something will go wrong. So they built the throne really, really high, like, and they didn't put any stairs, like, so that he wouldn't be able to get onto the throne. They wanted to make him look like a fool. So that was how they were going to prove that he was a fool, because he couldn't get on the throne. I don't know. This story moves very quickly when we were translating. We were just like, oh. But so then he goes and he goes to start his teaching, and they're all waiting, like, how's he going to do it? You know, he's going to look like an idiot. And then he just put his hands down on the throne. He like smacked it, and he went flying up and just landed right on top of the throne. And then he looked at all the whole monastery was there, the abbot and all the high monks, because they invited everybody to try to get him kicked out. And then he looked down at them, and now they knew their plan was probably going to be a failure, because he, but there were still some who were hoping that he was going to prove to be a fool. And so he said to them, what do you want me to teach you? Do you want me to teach you something that you already know? Or do you want me to teach you something new? And they're like, oh yeah, you want to teach us something new. Let's see what you got. So from the top of his throne that was too high, he started to recite the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, which had never been heard before. You know, he had just written it. And people were blown away. You know, not in this biography, but I think I read somewhere else that like people were attaining realizations throughout hearing it. You know, they're seeing emptiness and attaining nirvana just sitting there listening to him telling the Bodhisattva's way of life. And when he got to the 9th chapter, which is the chapter on emptiness and wisdom, he got to the line about what's real and what's unreal. And then he started to rise up into the sky. And he started to go really high. But he wanted to keep teaching, so he started to speak really loud. And his voice was booming, and all the monks were trying to take notes and write down what he said. And he flew away while still reciting the text. So there's a big debate for like the next couple hundred years about how many chapters are actually in the Bodhisattva's Guide to the Way of Life. But that's how it was taken down. That's how it was first taught. So he just flew away and he went somewhere else. And then the high monks at Nalanda, because there was dispute about how many chapters are actually in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, they sent some monks to go find him to clarify. I guess they couldn't handle the debate. And I think they also wanted to invite him back and apologize for... So they sent a couple monks, and then when they came and they found him, he told them that there were 10 chapters, and he recited it to them, and then he gave them a commentary on it, and then he told them about his other books, which are called the Compendium of the Trainings and the Compendium of the Sutras. So those are like his other big books, and Geshe-la said he was thinking about teaching the Compendium of the Trainings, but he thought it would put us all to sleep, so he decided against it. He said it's interesting, but it's not as sexy as the Bodhisattva's Guide to the Way of Life. Neither of them are, which is really amazing. So try to get your hands on that or get teachings on it. It's amazing. Geshe Michael teaches it in ACI courses 10, 11, and 12. So you can get some really awesome teachings on it right there. And His Holiness teaches it a lot, and you can find that stuff. And the 9th chapter is really amazing. I saw His Holiness teach the chapter on wisdom, and it was mind-blowing. I think he covered like the whole 18 ACI courses by talking about the 9th chapter. So some other cool stuff that Master Shantideva did. I'm trying to look for the ones that were really interesting. He went to this one particular region of India where there was a king, and the king was always kind of disguising himself as a beggar, but at this particular time they knew he was a great sage. And I think this was in East India somewhere, doesn't say, but there was this king, a Buddhist king, and the king had been threatened, and people were threatening his life and threatening his kingdom. So these servants of the king sought out Master Shantideva to be the king's bodyguard. And so he accepted, but as the masters do, they usually do something a little bit trickier, like play pranks on people. So he showed up with a wooden sword. The sword was blessed by Manjushri, but to everybody it was just this wooden sword, and they're just like, oh Jesus, like, what is this guy gonna do? What is he gonna do, like, if people attack the king? And so they are all like, all right, how are you gonna protect the king? What's wrong with you? You know, like, show us your sword, let's see, pull it out. And he was like, no, you don't, you guys really don't want me to do that. And they're like, yeah, just pull it out. And he's like, oh, no. And then the king was like, pull it out. And then Shantideva said, I could pull out the sword, but it will injure your highness. Like, your highness will be severely hurt if I were to do that. And the king didn't believe it, so he said, fuck it, pull it out. Excuse my language. That's what Geshe-la said. He said, I don't care, pull out the sword. So Shantideva said, okay, I'll pull it out, but you cover one eye and I'll do it. So the king covered one eye, and Shantideva pulled out the sword that was blessed by Manjushri, and like blinding rays of light started to shine out from it, and it blinded the king's other eye. And then the king was so happy and he became a Buddhist. So he apologized, you know, he supplicated himself or to Shantideva, and he got rid of his beliefs or, you know, let go of his cynicism and became a follower of Master Shantideva. So that's another miraculous story. And here's another really cool one of Master Shantideva. You guys have time? Is everybody okay? Because I got stories. All right. He went to a part of India called Sri Parvati, and he was practicing Tantra there and posing as a mendicant in the woods. And he was living off discarded animal remnants. And he was drinking the wastewater from washed dishes. You know, like, so he was drinking really gross stuff. And then some of his servants thought that they just wanted to torment him a little bit or chastise him because they thought he was really pathetic. So they threw boiling water on him. And the boiling water didn't do anything to him. It didn't affect him. It just like bounced off and it didn't bother him. And he just kept on his way. So maybe that gave him some kind of influence. But in that same realm, around the same time, there was a... Okay, I'll give you guys a little bit of a preface here. A lot of times in the scriptures, you find these stories of disputes between non-Buddhists and Buddhists. And I think they're usually Hindus. And I think that's just how India was at that time. It was Hindus and Buddhists. And they're always debating each other and stuff like that. So in this particular story, a Hindu sage named Shankara, he drew a mandala of Ishvara in the sky. Or I think he would draw it every morning. And he said that if there was that this particular king was Buddhist, and I guess they were all kind of living side by side, and this Hindu sage drew a mandala in the sky of Ishvara, and he said, if nobody can destroy it, then I'm going to destroy all of the Buddhist temples, burn all the Buddhist books, and convert everybody here to Hinduism. They have to join. So all of the king's highest sages and the sages of the land tried to destroy the mandala that was drawn in the sky, and they couldn't do it. And then the servants went to the king and they're like, we saw this crazy dude in the woods who was drinking the dishwater and we threw boiling water on him and it didn't do anything. And the king was like, go get him. You know, like it says the king, cause the king was grieving before that, you know, he figured his everything that was about to get destroyed, everything that he loved. And then he got so excited when he heard about this beggar. So they went and found him in the woods. He was living under the foot of a tree, which is what monks are really supposed to be doing, right? Living at the foot of a tree. And they asked him if he could do it. So he said he could, and he told them to fill a pitcher with water, bring two strips of cloth, make a fire, and then he'd be able to do it. So they fulfilled his wishes, you know, the servants did. And the next morning, as Shankara, the evil Hindu sage, was drawing the mandala in the sky, Master Shantideva created a giant tornado using the strips of cloth and the fire and the pitcher of water. Somehow he turned that into some kind of massive tornado that... So Shankara was just starting his mandala that day. He'd only drawn the east door, which I guess you draw first, right, Rosa? And he destroyed that, but then it also destroyed the whole entire village and flattened everything and like ripped all the shrubbery and just pulled everything up into the sky, and all the people had to flee. But it's really funny. I don't even want to go too much into it because it gets kind of into like, it really scared all the Hindus away, you know. But we love Hindus. I mean, you know, Hindus are great. This was just a particularly bad group. It was like the Cobra Kai of Hindus. So So after all the chaos and destruction, a ray of light shot out of his Ajna chakra, and in that ray of light he showed the king and the queen, and their clothes had blown off and they were covered with dust. But then he restored them, he bathed them, like he just made a bath happen upon them and gave them brand new clothes and made fire to dry them. And then everybody else in the village, and he kind of healed everything with a light that was emanating out of his third eye, and everybody converted to Buddhism. I don't write it. This is what's... So there's more. There's like four more little stories, but it's basically that he debated people and defeated them and turned rice into more rice that could feed everybody. He did a lot of really cool miraculous stuff. And if you're interested, if somebody really wants, I can give you when I finish transcribing what Geshe-la told me, I can write out and give it to you, the biography of Master Shantideva. All right. I'll tell you a little story. So he was from the emptiness side. That's him there. And now we'll do a story of a teacher from the compassion side that probably most of you have heard before. Yeah.
So he was born and then he died, but he had
750 AD.
Born or dead?
What?
Estimated.
Oh, yeah, right around 750. Right, so we don't know exactly.
Who wrote the biography? What are you talking
about? Good question. It was I'm trying to remember his name. Bhutan Rinpoche? Bhutan Rinpoche. Bhutan Rinpoche. Yeah, he was a famous biographer. I mean, he was a famous lama, but he's partly famous for writing a lot of biographies. And this was in the early days. I think he was before Jason Kapa, or around the time of Jason Kapa. Bhutan Rinpoche. Thank you for asking. I meant to say that. They were probably recorded. Tibetans were pretty good about recording those stories. So that might have even been carved by Bhutan Rinpoche or by his students.
No, but I meant all the stories of Shantideva, either orally or by other recordings that stuck them together.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably passed down orally for a time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, they recorded a lot of stuff in India too. You know, they would write it on palm leaves, and so these stories may have been written down. I don't know. We could ask Geshe-la, he might know. Okay, so one of the teachers who's pictured here, I think it's the top one actually. It is Tome Asanga. So we'll talk a little bit about him. And he received teachings directly from Lord Maitreya. And he's one of the most famous writers in Buddhist history. Does anybody want to name one text written by Master Asanga? Yeah. Ornament of Realization. Abhisamaya Alamkara. Anything else? Yeah. Uttara Tantra is another famous one that Geshe-la taught. I think there's five great books of Maitreya that were all written down by Master Asanga. But the one that's one of the five great books of Buddhism is Ornament of Realization. And that's what Geshe Michael has been referencing a lot and what the monks study a lot in the monastery. So, and it's said that those books were written by Lord Maitreya and just written down by Master Asanga. But here's a really cool story about when they met, which many of you have heard before, but it's fun. Okay, so we have friends that are doing a 3-year, 3-month, 3-day retreat, and that seems like a long time, and it is. But back in the day, and even still to this day, people did 12-year retreats. It takes a while, right? I mean, getting enlightened is hard. And it can take some time. So you got to get your mind quiet and all that. So it's said that he was doing a 12-year-long retreat in a cave, Master Asanga was. And he was doing a particular practice. He was doing a sadhana to reach Maitreya. So the whole time, 12 years, every day, he's just sitting there trying to reach Maitreya for 12 years. And he didn't really meet him. He left the cave. I think, you know, time was up. He's 12 years older. And he was walking down the road right after leaving the cave. And in the road, he saw a female dog with festering wounds. She was dying. And in those wounds were maggots and bugs. And in his heart, you know, he was very sensitive. I mean, I've done a couple of retreats. My first retreat was 4 days. And afterwards, I was really sensitive. So like the whole next day, I was like, I just sat in my trailer and like played my guitar. So after 12 years, like you just imagine. So he saw this thing and really high compassion, Ningje Chenpo, right, Adam, arose in his heart. And he wanted to save this female dog. So he bent down to try to help the dog. And then he realized that if he removed the maggots, gusanitos de moscas, if he removed them, he would kill them. So he decided to cut off a piece of his flesh to, Aaron doesn't like it when I say flesh, cut off a piece of his flesh and put the maggots in there so as not to kill them. But he knew if he left them there, it would kill the dog, right? That's why he would go to such an extent. So he went to town and traded, like, I don't know what he must have had, some piece of cloth or something. He gave it as collateral and borrowed a golden razor blade. And with that razor blade, he cut off a piece of his flesh. And then he went, gave the razor blade back, went back with his flesh, and then went to go take the maggots out of the dog. And when he went to do that, he realized that if he touched them, he would crush them because they're so fragile. So instead of picking them up with his fingers to remove them from the dog, he decided he had to do it with his tongue. So he started leaning over to pick the maggots out of the dog with his tongue. And as soon as he was about to touch the first maggot, the dog wasn't there anymore. And there was a brilliant flash of light. And then Maitreya appeared. And then this is the first time they met, right? So Master Asanga was like, oh, damn. You know, he was like, that's what it said. That's what it said it said that in Tibetan. It said, oh my gosh, my one father, he had some respect, my holy protector. And then he got a little bit irreverent because he was a little bit frustrated. So he was like, I exerted myself with hundreds of exhausting practices for 12 years and you didn't come. There's nothing happened. He goes, here you are, a vast ocean of rain clouds. Here I am, dying of thirst, burning and tormented, and you didn't help me. I did my practice incessantly and you didn't come. He said, your compassion seems a little something like that, deficient. I don't know. Deficient. I don't know. What's up with your compassion, man? But Maitreya was, you know, he wasn't going to be hard on him now. That's rare that you hear somebody talk to a Buddha that way. But he was pissed. So he said, Maitreya replied and he said, The king of the gods may send rain down, but if the seeds are not ready, nothing will grow. And it says that in Tibetan, the seeds, sabun. He says, the Buddhas themselves may come to this world, But if you have no kelwa, virtue, you'll see nothing. He said, I was there from the beginning, but because of the veils over your eyes, you couldn't see me. But now, Mahakaruna, you guys know what that is? Nyingje Chenpo, great compassion, has been born in your heart, and those obstacles have been cleared, and now you see me. And then he says, so he wants to prove it to him, right? He explained it to him, but he wants to like make sure that he gets the point. So he says, that being the case, you should put me on your shoulders and run around town and see what happens. You should show me to other people and see if they can see me. So he did, you know, he picked him up and he was so happy and he put him on his shoulders and he ran into the village and all people saw was him carrying a festering dead dog on his shoulders and running around like a maniac. So then Master Asanga believed truly that you have to have great compassion to be able to see him.
I think it was reported that some, like one person saw like a golden toe.
Yeah. I heard that too. That wasn't in this bio though. But yeah. And this is also coming from Bhutum Rinpoche. Just so you guys know where this is coming from. And then, somebody had a little bit of kelwa. It's out there, you know, there's good ones.
who is his teacher?
Master Asanga? Uh-huh. Well, Maitreya is his teacher. Before that, like, who taught him? I don't know.
Like, who taught him about Maitreya?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. A lot of those guys, those masters, you kind of, when they've had a lineage directly from a deity, there's not a lot of information about their rest of their lineage. Like Jason Kapa, we do know about his teacher, Randhawa, right? But a lot of times you don't hear so much about. It seems like Master Asanga was doing some sort of sadhana, a practice to reach Maitreya, like a meditation, visualization, purification of his mind to be able to touch and, you know, communicate directly with that angel.
So somebody would have told him.
Somebody instructed him, I'm sure. I don't know who Master Asanga's teacher was. The story of Master Asanga is that there was a nun. And somebody prophesies to this nun. I don't know who prophesies to you. Somebody prophesies to this nun that if she were to have two children, one by a king and one by a monk, or by a Brahmin, sorry, not a monk. One by a Brahmin, yeah. A Brahmin was a yogi or a high caste practitioner, a religious caste, that they would both be great. And so she did it. And she had these children. And one of them is Master Asanga and his half-brother, Master Vasubandhu. And they were both very famous, incredible practitioners. Master Vasubandhu wrote... Yeah! And Master Asanga wrote The Ornament of Realization and compiled them from what Maitreya was telling him. So perhaps their mother was... just a guess, you know. Honestly, I don't know. It's an interesting question. Maybe we could use the ACIP database to find out. Yeah. Okay, so after that, Maitreya said to Master Asanga, now that you've reached me, now that you've found me, what do you wish of me? And so Maitreya said, I just want to spread the Mahayana Dharma. So Maitreya said, all right, grab onto my robes. He said some particular part of the robe, I can't remember, shab something, or, yep, like part of the skirt, right, or something. And so he said, grab onto that. And then he grabbed on and they flew to Gandan Paradise. And they stayed for what seemed like, I don't know, an afternoon or a couple days or something like that. And Lord Maitreya taught him so much. He taught him everything that we have passed down from him, the Ornament of Realization, you know, Uttara Tantra, and all the other great books of Maitreya. And then he came back, and 50 years had passed. So this is actually going to come up really soon in the Lamrim, and I think that's one of the reasons Geshe-la wanted me to include this story, because Pabongka Rinpoche uses it as an example of the weirdness of time and how it doesn't correspond directly. Time in the human world in Jambudvipa, which is the Sanskrit name of the southern continent, which is the world we live in. It's a cool word, right? They say that that sound, Jambu, is the sound of a coconut falling off a tree into the water. I think that's so cool. I would name a world after that or something. Anyway, so the time here is it's relative, right? Like in the God realm, just an afternoon is 50 years. And then there was some funny notation in the text that we were translating, that he was translating, let me be honest. from now on, I'm going to say we, though, but you guys know what I mean. It said 50 years or 53. Like there's some dispute, and it was really important to like, it was either 50 years or 53 years, and that's not clear. So anyway, that's a story from Master Asanga. So when you're doing this visualization, or when you're visualizing the lamas from the compassion side, you can think of Master Asanga and you can think of that story. And that's kind of cool. I liked it. So, do you guys, is everybody tired, or do we have time for another one? Okay. You all right, Rob? All right. What's that? All right, well, I'll take a sip of tea real quick. We'll go back to the emptiness side. This is the teacher I really wanted to talk about. My favorite, the sexiest of them all. Yeah, of course. I was going to. Who is it going to be? Arya Nagarjuna. Oh, I didn't write that much of it down. Try to do it from memory. So, sorry? You, somebody else, let's see, who's Master Nagarjuna here? Yeah, yeah. He's the only Lama who always has snakes in his head, coming out of his head, so. Yeah. And we can learn about that right now. But why does he have snakes coming out of his head? So it's him, the one on top. He's kind of like, after Manjushri, he's like the boss. Why? Yeah, he founded the middle way. I mean, right, Lord Buddha really founded the middle way with the second turning of the wheel, which is where he taught the true meaning of emptiness, according to our school. But Nagarjuna is credited with really like establishing the middle way philosophy and spreading it. And he was prophesized widely. He's prophesized by Lord Buddha in many sutras. I'll read that to you first. Lord Buddha said, after I, the Tathagata, have passed away, and 400 years have passed, a bhikshu, the Naga, shall appear, of great faith and benefit to the teaching. He shall achieve the stage of a great joy, and for 600 years remain living. And so that's the one of the prophecies from Lord Buddha about Nagarjuna coming to this world. So, and he did, it's said that he lived for 600 years. And so this was around 200 AD, something like that. 1 or 200 AD, Nagarjuna. Oh, by the way, Master Asanga, that was around 350 AD. Okay. So I'll just give some quick stories because it's getting late. So, there was a Brahmin in India, and he had no sons, and he wanted a son. And so signs appeared to him in a dream that if he were to make offering to 100 hungry people, that he'd be able to bear a son. So he offered food to 100 hungry people, and it worked. And he was able to have a son. And then, after the baby was born, it was prophesied by a soothsayer, that's such a cool word, that if the baby would die within 7 days unless he made offering to 100 monks. So he made offering to 100 monks. And then it was prophesied that the boy would only be able to live 7 years. So the parents raised him to 7, and then when he turned 7, they loved him so much, they didn't think they'd bear to be able to part, to see his corpse. They wouldn't bear to be able to see his corpse. So they sent him on a journey with some servants as his 7th birthday approached. And during that journey, he started having visions of a god who was a emanation of Lokeshvara. I'm not sure who Lokeshvara is. Is it? Okay, I was thinking it probably was. So he started having visions of emanations of Chenrezig. And then they got to Nalanda Monastery. I don't know if they were headed there or if they just happened to be passing by it. And they just happened to be passing by Master Saraha's dwelling. As to those of you who've studied know who Master Saraha is. He was, I guess, one of his main teachers, the main teachers of Nagarjuna, and a very profound teacher. When they were passing his door, this almost seven-year-old boy started to recite, holy poetry. And then Master Saraha was like, what's going on? You know, he came out there and found them, and the servants told them of the boy's plight. So Master Saraha, perceived that if the child were to take the vows of a renunciate, then he would live. So he taught him, first he taught him a sadhana. Let me see if I wrote what's... It was, he initiated him into the mandala of Amitabha, which conquers the Lord of Death. So it's a particular sadhana for conquering the Lord of Death. And then he was instructed to recite certain mantras that were going to help prolong his life and strengthen his life force. Dharani mantras. And then he was given even more special mantras to recite for the eve of his 7th birthday. And he did. And it worked. The birthday passed and he was still alive. And then he took the renunciate vows. And then when he turned 8, he took full ordination vows from Master Saraha, I believe. And during that time, he received initiation into Guhya Samaja. And his ordination name was Bhikshu Srimanta. And he also received teachings from this Bodhisattva, Ratnamati, who was an emanation of Manjushri. And during that time, he became a master of Sutra and Tantra. And he started studying science at some point during his young life too, and alchemy. He got really into alchemy, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with. I'm probably talking too fast. Alchemia. He was studying the transmutation of substances, and specifically he was learning how to turn metals into gold, and he got really good at that. And at some point, in order to really get teachings on how to do it, he had to go to this remote island somewhere not close to Nalanda, because he had to use a siddhi, a miracle power of swift-footedness. That's so cool. So he had some kind of sandalwood. Hold on. He had 2 charms of sandalwood leaves that gave him that power. And he put, you guys have heard this story, right? He put one of them in his shoe and he had the other one in his hand. And with the charm, he was able to access that miracle power of moving very quickly. And I believe it's flying too, because it got him to this island. So he got to the island, and on that island was a master alchemist, Brahmin. And he asked the Brahmin for teachings on how to transform substances. And the Brahmin said, knowledge can only be given in exchange for gold or for other wisdom. And so Nagarjuna said, well, we'll have to trade wisdom for wisdom, and I'll give you my power of swift-footedness. But he knew that this Brahmin was a little bit tricky and didn't want to give the powers away to anybody. He wanted to keep it for himself. But he knew that the Brahmin would do it if he was convinced. So he thought that if Nagarjuna gave him the power, he wasn't Nagarjuna at this point, right? His name was Bhikshu Shirimanta. Anyway, he thought that if he gave him that charm, which contained the power of moving from here to there, then he'd be stuck on the island and he wouldn't be able to leave. But that's why he had stashed one in his shoe. You know, he was thinking ahead. So he gave him the charm, and then the master Brahmin taught him alchemy, and he taught him how to transform metals into gold. And then when he got the wisdom, he took his other charm and swiftly footed back to Nalanda. And it was a very good time for him to get back there with that power, because Nalanda had been undergoing a really terrible famine, and a lot of people in the Magadha, I think is the name of the region of India, or was the name of it, where Nalanda is. And many people were dying from hunger, and the monks were starting to get sick. So he was able to turn vast quantities of iron into gold, and then he took the gold somewhere and was able to trade that for food. And he kept the monastery going and kept the monks alive. And so like that, he got appointed abbot of the monastery. And then he really cleaned house. Because apparently during that time, there was a lot of monks who weren't really keeping their vows. And so he just kicked them all out. And then there was a lot of monks who were wonderful, amazing masters of the three baskets. That's what it said in there. And he, you know, supported them. And he was a great abbot while he was there. And he had a lot of disciples. You know, many people wanted to learn from him. And two of his disciples were Nagas, which are, Geshe-la talked a little bit about this in this retreat so far, right? Nagas are kind of like dragons, maybe, or snakes. They're these lizard-like beings, and they don't live here. They live in a different realm, but they can come here if they want to. But they live in maybe in a more pure realm. Aaron and I just watched this awesome movie called The Sorcerer and the White Serpent, and it was so cool, and it's about Nagas and Buddhist monks, and Jet Li is like the star. And he's the abbot of this monastery, and he's really tough. And it's awesome. You guys should see it. So anyway, he had two disciples, and every time they were around, it smelled like sandalwood. And I don't know if you guys have smelled sandalwood, but it's really a beautiful, beautiful scent. And if you have a sandalwood mala, you rub them, and it smells so amazing. I had one. I gave it away, but I miss it. So when they were around, he said, what's up with you guys? And he said, oh, we're Nagas are attracted to wisdom too. They're attracted to shiny things, and they're attracted to wisdom. And so I think that's why they like Nagarjuna, because he's wise and he had something to share with them. And they like Dharma, and they get Dharma. They collect it and they hoard it. They stash stuff. And they're real. Don't doubt that they're real. I know they're real. We just don't see them. Anyway, so two of his disciples were Nagas, and he said, why does it always smell like sandalwood when you're around, and when you leave, the smell goes away? And they told him that they had to anoint themselves with sandalwood oil in order to protect themselves from the impurities of the human realm. And so Bhikshu Shrimanta is like, well, I'm going to get some of that stuff. Where can I get some of that sandalwood oil? Because I need some for a Tara statue that I have. He was really into building stupas and temples and statues and holy images, which is pretty cool. And so he told them, I'd really like to get some of that. And they said, yeah, all right, but we can't just give it to you. We have to ask our father, who is Taksaka, Lord of the Nagas. So they were both like princes of Nagas. So they went back and they asked him, and they said, yeah, okay, you can have it, but you have to come to our land, to the Naga realm. And so Nagarjuna thought about it. Bhikshu Srimanta thought about it, and he's like, okay, it could be dangerous, but I'll go because they have many scriptures that I could bring back to help spread the Mahayana Dharma, and they have this Naga clay. So like I said, he liked to build temples, and I guess you need Naga clay to build temples and stupas. So he's like, I gotta get some of that and get that sandalwood oil. So he's, all right, I'll do it. You know, he decided for the benefit of sentient beings, he would go. And he went, and they loved him. Like, they're just like, oh, this guy is amazing. You know, he taught them Dharma. Like, they were just really attracted to him. And they begged him to stay. You know, he said, I can't stay. I have to go back because I have many disciples and people are waiting for me. So he said, I'll come back, though, but I really want to bring the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So from the Naga realm, which is like somewhere deep underwater or something, he brought back the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in 1,000 verses. You guys still with me? Okay. So I lost a couple, but... So they gave it to him, but they kept the last few verses. And then that's why, if anybody gets really into sutras, you'll see that the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in 1,000 verses... And the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in 800 verses, the last few verses are the same. And that's because they didn't give him the last few verses. The Nagas were like trying to assure that he would come back. But they gave him everything he wanted. And then he came back, and some Nagas came back with him as his disciples, and they really loved him. And so when he would be teaching Bhikshu Srimanta, and it was hot in India and it was really sunny, they would like make a little shade for him. The snakes, the Naga beings, would create a hood for him so that he wouldn't have the sun in his face when he was teaching. And that's why he has the word Naga in his name. Because people were like, oh, wow, you know. People were amazed that he had... Mostly humans didn't achieve that kind of dominion over the Naga beings. So, but he was kind of like lord of the Nagas. So they gave him that Naga in his name. And Arjuna... Does anybody know who Arjuna is? Yeah. And what was his weapon? Yeah, he was an archer. So if anybody knows the Mahabharata, and at least the Bhagavad Gita, he's this famous archer in ancient India. And he was known to be very skillful, and he could shoot arrows faster than anybody. So his swiftness... skillfulness and ability to spread the Mahayana Dharma like an arrow into people's hearts, they started calling him Arjuna. So that's how he got the name Naga Arjuna, because he's the lord of snakes who skillfully can pierce people's hearts with the arrow of Mahayana Dharma. That's cool, right? And so we're almost done. Don't worry. I'm sorry that we're going so late, but this is fun for me. So the other part of it, there's a lot more to his story, but I'll just mention his death, because they say he lived for 600 years. And as an alchemist, he had learned the secrets for immortality, not to mention that he was probably a Buddha or very highly evolved being. Here's the story of his death. A young prince was presented with a jewel necklace or some jewels, and he gave them to his mother, and he said, "Mother, I will wear these jewels when I become crowned king." And his mother said, "No, you're never going to be crowned king. Because your father's going to live forever. Because your father and Nagarjuna worked something out." At this time, Nagarjuna was Nagarjuna. They worked something out that as long as Nagarjuna's alive, your father will be alive, and Nagarjuna is going to live forever because he's found immortality. So this kid like threw a fit. He was a wicked little prince. And he just plotted and schemed and tried to figure a way to kill his father, I guess. Because he really wanted to be king. So he talked to his mother about it, and his mother said, okay, don't worry. I got an idea. Nagarjuna is a bodhisattva. So if you ask him for his head, he'll give it to you. Which is, if you guys read some of the stories of the famous saints, they do stuff like that, like rip their eyes out and give them to people. Don't try it, though. Because we're like, you can be a saint and not do that, and we're probably not at that level. So that was her idea. She said, you know, if you ask him for his head, he'll give it to you. So he did it. The prince, he went to Nagarjuna and he asked him for his head, and Nagarjuna said, okay, you know, sure, no problem. You know, death is nothing to me, I don't care. Probably just nobody had asked him to die before. That's the only reason he stayed alive so long. So he, you know, he offered his head, and the kid tried to hit it with a sword, and it didn't do anything. It didn't barely cut him. And Nagarjuna's like, sorry, man, I don't know. Like, I'm trying. And then Nagarjuna's like, let me think about this. We'll make it happen. And so he thought about it, and he perceived that he, at some point, had killed a bug by stepping on a blade of grass. He had somewhere deep, deep, deep in his heart, he had a negative karma from killing a bug with a blade of grass or on a blade of grass. So he told the prince, if you cut my neck with a blade of grass, you'll be able to decapitate me. And so he did it, and he decapitated him. And they say that his blood was like liquid gold, and it looked like his body was just going to come right back together. So the kid brought his head pretty far away. And they say that to this day, the body and the head are still moving ever so slowly back together for Nagarjuna to, you know, re-emerge. And they say he lived for 600 years. And that's the story of Nagarjuna's death. Can anybody name something that he wrote? Yeah, the Mula Madhyamika Karika, the root text on wisdom, which is like the coolest thing ever. Is Joel in here? No. It's amazing. Oh, there you are. Did you ever get a copy of it? Like,
oh, yeah, maybe.
I remember Joel was telling me, he's like, I always want to get it and read it like poetry. Because it's like that. It's like if you read it, it's so beautiful and it doesn't necessarily make sense. I think a lot of what you're reading is meant to just throw your mind into an altered state. And it's like he was writing it on, you know, something. But he's just so highly realized, and he's talking about emptiness. He's talking about the highest ultimate nature of reality, and it's incredible. And so if you ever get a chance to hear or read some of the verses from the root text on wisdom, it's incredible. And there's a book called Ocean of Reasoning, which you can get, which is Jason Kappa's commentary. Yeah, the book Jhimpa Khosras are the readings are on the Diamond Mountain website, right?
I don't know. I don't
know. If they're not online, we'll try to make them available somewhere. But I think that they're on the Diamond Mountain University website. And they're amazing courses, and you can listen to them. I know Book Jhimpa 9 is that, I think 8. Yeah. Anyway, it's incredible. So I can't even be tell you any quotes from Nagarjuna because they'll make our heads explode or something. If anybody's got any good ones. He talks a lot about how things can never possibly be anything. Okay. Cool. I mean, I have some right here, but I just don't feel adequate to say it.
Uh,
Oh, here's something nice. This is not about emptiness. But he says, there is no austerity like patience, so do not give way to anger. By overcoming anger, the Buddha acknowledged, one attains the stage of non-returning, which is like nirvana. So that's kind of nice. Let's see if I can find something on emptiness. No. Anyway, you can find his quotes. There's a book called A Letter to a Friend, or Nagarjuna's Letter, written by Ken Rinpoche, Geshe La's teacher, and you can find that book. But I think everybody's tired. So it's time to go to bed. It's very late, actually. Sorry, but that was fun. Let's just dedicate. Puki chuk shing me tok cham ri rab ling shin in de gin pa di sangye shing du mik te wo war gi Drokun nam dak shing la drupa sho. Iram guru radna mandala kam nivyatayami. Di ke wokun sunam yeshe tsok tsok shing. Sunam yeshe le jung wei. Dampa kuni topa sho. Thank you. Sorry for keeping us so late. I just got away from me.